yet to step up and speak out.
Hey, dude, I'm walking here.
Sorry, I didn't see you.
A public service message from the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, who want to keep everyone well connected with healthy bones.
HFC's associate degree program in automotive technology includes detailed instruction related to the various systems found on today's vehicles. This program is designed to provide students with a thorough knowledge of the technical aspects of the automobile and to develop a certain level of manual skill in servicing, testing, and diagnosing. Classroom and laboratory classes provide students with the experience and understanding they'll need to qualify in numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Hey boys and girls, if you like songs that go from this to something like this, then you should check out my show, Lights Out on WHFR Dearborn, hosted by yours truly, Mr. Camo. Playing the best in techno, trance, industrial, rave, drum and bass, breaks, and everything that involves electronic. So even though it's the middle of the day, we can still turn the lights out and have a party. Every Wednesday from 2 to 4 p.m. on the only station making waves, WHFR Dearborn.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. Of all the many cases of what is termed high strangeness in the UFO phenomenon, the Andreasen affair ranks among the top. Betty Andreasen Luca was abducted by otherworldly beings in January of 1967 in the presence of multiple witnesses. She underwent an incredible journey into other worlds and or other dimensions, involving seemingly benevolent entities of light. Led by a number of teams of highly credentialed investigators, Betty endured numerous hypnosis sessions and voice stress tests. The scientific investigation left no stone unturned. In the final analysis, her experience is one of the most thoroughly investigated and well-documented cases in ufology. Her husband, Robert, has had his own UFO experiences, which intertwined with Betty's even before they met in the physical world. No less than five books were written by UFO investigator Raymond Fowler concerning Betty's involvement with otherworldly beings, and the messages they have for mankind. And so we're privileged to have both Bob and Betty on the line with us today. Bob and Betty, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, David.
Thank you for having us on.
Oh, I appreciate you coming on. It's really an honor to have you on because, like I told you in an email, I read this book, The Andreasen Affair, back in... 80s. And I was very, very taken aback with it. And I thought, gee, this is one strange case. But so for clarity for our listeners, Betty, your last name was Andreasen at the time in 67, right?
Exactly.
Oh, okay. And you have since become Betty Luka.
Exactly.
Still called the Andreasen Affair because that's who you were at the time.
Right.
So let's start with Betty then. Please give our listeners an overview of the 1967 experience.
Okay. My husband was in the hospital from an auto accident, and I was at home with my seven children, and my mother and father came to stay with me to help out while I was having to go to the hospital off and on. And it was the evening of January 25th, and what happened was the kids were in the living room, and they were watching a show. My mother and father were in there with them, and I went into the living room with them. And all of a sudden, the show was cut off. The electricity went down, and we suddenly saw a reddish-orange pulsing red light coming through the pantry window. Well, my father immediately got up, and he rushed in back of me and went out to the area. I was not aware of this at the time. And so I got up and I told the children and said, now just be quiet. It either is police or the fire department that's out there. I'll go out to see what's going on. You all sit still, because they were quite young children. And I didn't want them running about whatever was going on. Right. When I went out into the living room, I mean from the living room to the kitchen, all of a sudden I was standing there, and right through the door came five strange-looking beings. They moved right through the heavy wooden door. And as they stood there, I could see they had a large head, gray skin, with very black, big eyes. They were dressed in blue uniforms, had a sash across the chest and a belt, and they also had an emblem like an eagle or a bird on their arm, the patch.
Mm-hmm.
As I stood there, you know, there was at first a fear feeling, but then all of a sudden I felt love and peace. And I was thinking in my mind, entertain the strangers, for they may be angels unaware. And this is what I was thinking. It had to be an angel or angels that came through the door like that. And so I kind of felt a little more at ease. And the leader also helped me, because it was talking to me through my mind and saying something, and I thought, they must be hungry. So I went to the refrigerator, got some meat in a frying pan, started to cook it on the stove, and a little bit of smoke came up, and I saw the leader jump back as if startled. And then again, I heard the voice inside, no, we don't want this. We want knowledge tried by fire. And so I realized, they weren't here to have a dinner or anything. So at that time, I moved with them into the living room. And as we entered the living room, I could see my children and mother was sitting very still, as if time had stopped for them. And that made me feel a little shook up to see something like that. But I reached down on the end table for a Bible. I think it was my daughter Becky's Bible. She was given from the People's Church. And I handed it to the leader. When he put his hand out to hold on to the book, I could see the three fingers. There was not five like humans have, only three fingers. He put it in his hand, and then he took his other hand and he waved it over the book, and three other smaller books appeared. And he handed them to the three beings beside him, and they were dressed exactly like him.
It's like he multiplied the Bible?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it was just as if he multiplied it. However, it was thinner, There was no typing or you know, black letters on it, because when they held it in their hand, the pages automatically turned one after another. All three of those standing next to him was doing this, and it was like bright white light was shining off those pages. Mm. And it seemed as if they were consuming what was in there with their eyes.
Right.
And after that, the leader said his name was Kwasgoth, and he was giving me something that for an initiation, and I would have it for 10 days, and I was supposed to read and study as much of it as possible. And at that point, I still felt fearful about my children, and I think Kwasgoth knew it. And he took Becky, my oldest daughter, out of that state, and she stood up, and she could not move away as if to walk away or over toward me. She just stood there and looked with her eyes and could see different things going on. So that made me feel more comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
At that particular point, I put the thin blue book down on the end table, and I was like taken in back of the leader, who was Kwasgoth, and we went out into the kitchen. And as we went out into the kitchen, we went right through the wooden door.
You too.
I could not feel anything around me. We just as if we were walking through air, we went right through the wooden door.
Mm-hmm.
And as we got out into the yard, we went around to the left a little bit and up the hill, and there was the craft. It was sort of the cylinder, the round circular type craft. And on the bottom, he stood there, and on the bottom, he raised his hand, and when he did, I could see underneath how the craft looked. It looked like just a window after he raised his hand, and I could see the lower balls of crystal, cut crystal, were on the bottom, and it had a stem that clung to the top of those huge round crystal balls, and it went up, and there was another light or crystal on top, and it had like streaks of light coming out of that crystal ball. And then also on the armature that held the two balls, the one on top and bottom, it stretched out, and it had like a wheel, another crystal wheel in between it. It was holding on to that. And there was a round tube all around this. There were about three of those objects below in the craft. Yes, I've drawn a lot of pictures in the book, The Andreas Affair, so people can see exactly what I saw and what I went through, because it's kind of hard sometimes to explain it, you know, because it's so unusual.
Right. Well, you're a good artist, too, I must say.
Well, thank you so very much.
You depicted those beings very well. And your father saw these beings as well, right?
Yes, David. Actually, he was the first to see the beings.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't want to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me what he had seen.
Right.
But he didn't want to get involved because he was afraid that he would lose his Social Security. My mother and father were living on Social Security, so they were really leery of, you know, getting into any kind of a problem that would be taken away from, their livelihood would be taken away from them.
So when you say he didn't want to get involved, you mean he didn't want to report this, is that it?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I knew what he had seen, but the thing is, the investigators they asked me, would you be willing to ask your father if he would talk with us about it, you know? And that's when I approached my father and said, Daddy, will you tell them exactly what you had seen? And that's when he said, no, I don't want to get involved because of my Social Security.
Yeah, well, I don't blame him for worrying about that.
Yeah.
There's so many people who don't want to get involved for fear of ridicule, or they'll lose their government contract or their government stipend, whatever it is.
Right, but I said to him, Daddy, you know, I need support. I know you saw them, and I saw them. You know, I need your support also to let the investigators know what you saw. And he thought they looked like small children dressed in costumes, moon man costumes, he said, coming down the hill. They were hopping. You know, it was a slight hill there. Mm. They were up and down, just hopping along and coming in. Mm. And evidently after they must have seen my father in the window and done something to keep him there, because when they first came in, there were five of them. Mm. But after, when we went into the living room, there were four. There was Lita Quasgar and three others. Mm. And then the fifth one evidently had gone over to where my father was.
Okay. So your daughter, Becky, she saw them as well?
Yes, she did.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, because three or four days later, she came to me and she said, Mommy, I keep on having a terrible dream that these strange people are in our house. Mm-hmm. And I realized then, you know, because they had taken her, let her stand up and watch briefly, that she saw what was going on. I guess it was around the time of the exchange of this in Blue Book. And so anyways, I said, I told her to be quiet because I didn't want my other children being frightened over it. And so I says, it happened, honey, but I don't want you saying anything to anybody about it. Mm. And I was going to show her the Thin Blue Book, which I was not supposed to do. Uh-huh. So I brought her into my bedroom, and our bedroom was on the lower floor. And I had it stored in the closet on the upper shelf, and I took it down, and we sat on the bed, and she put her hand on the top of it, on just the cover, and when she lifted her hand, there were all sparkles on her hand from it. And what's strange, David, is that ever since then, she has been able to write a very strange script or language, and I think it's because of her touching it.
Wow. Wow. And
but she was only around 12 years old at that time.
Has anybody been able to decipher, or can she?
Well, she does writings for people, you know, and what she has them do is write their name down, and then she places her hand on the name, and it's supposed to, evidently, she feels it's supposed to help them to understand more about themselves and understand more what they should do.
Hmm.
And then after she places her hand down on the name on the page or paper, she will begin to write, and she keeps on writing the language out.
But
I don't know if anybody has ever studied her language or not. I think it would be a good idea if somebody in that field would look at it and really study it.
All right. But there has to be a basis for these symbols or whatever they are before they can decipher. Yeah,
I see.
Yeah, so if they have no basis, then they can't decipher it.
Yeah.
I should send her, I should write my name down and send it to her. You know?
Well, she's going through some hardships right now.
Oh, no.
She's had cancer of the liver.
Oh, no.
And three in the stomach and also the esophagus, yeah. Which we've been going through a horrible time because of it. But thank God the Lord Jesus hears our prayers, and she's doing so, so much better. She's
good.
Almost healed now.
Well,
she's in
great.
Her last few times of chemo, and prayers are still going up.
Yeah, well, that's great news. That's great news. So then you get on the ship, and what happened then?
Well, after I was brought aboard the ship, I waited there for a little while, and it seemed like a long time I was waiting there, and they left, and then they came back for me. They took me into an upper room. It sort of turned around, the stairs turned sort of around, and as we were going up the stairs, I could look down, and it looked like there were more levels to the ship than, you know, outside showed. I don't know. They did tell me they could opulate and deopulate, which could make more of and less of. And so I don't know if that's how it happened, that I could see there were more levels to this craft when they brought me into the upper room. I was up in the upper room for a while. They came back for me, and then that's when they said they were going to measure me for light. Kwaska said he was going to measure me for light.
What does that mean, measure you for light?
I don't know what they mean, but I think it must mean how much spirit or faith, or that's what I'm thinking it must be.
Mm-hmm. So spiritually, you're light, like your aura.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, right, okay. So it's written about in the book that they, at one point, they had to cover you with some kind of liquid water and put breathing tubes in your nose and mouth.
Right. That was when they took me to a strange area. But before that, when they measured me for light, they thought they found something on the back of my... Kowalska said he was going to have to measure me physically. And he said, measure me physically. And I kind of objected because he had said, no, he was just going to measure me for light, and that was it.
Mm.
But I think they had other things in mind anyway, because... after I had been cleansed and changed into a garment, I was brought into that room. He measured me for light. Then he took needles, a long needle, and he put it up into my left nostril. And at first, I was really fearful of it, but he put his hand on my forehead, and he took away almost all the pain. So that wasn't bad. But when he pulled out the needle, there was like a BB-like device on the end of it, little pickers on a ball, like, was there. And then after that, he said that he was going to have to measure me physically and for procreation. And that's when he also had another needle, and he thrust it into my navel, and I could feel it moving around again. He put his hand on my forehead, and it took away a great deal of the pain, but it was frightening what was happening. He stopped, and there were three of the other beings there. They were dressed in silver suits, and they had this roll with this long, it looked like... cloth, a weaved cloth, and they had it pulled out of the roll and evidently were looking at it. And Kwaska came back to me by the side of the table that I was laying on, and he said something was missing. And I said, well, I've had a hysterectomy. So evidently he knew somehow.
That something was missing, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I did know, not too many people know about this, but I did have to have the hysterectomy because, while it's all in the new book, what had happened was after my little daughter had a terrible time, and I almost lost her. And then after that, because of it, my first husband said, you're going to the doctor and be checked, because he was worried, because I was laying on the bed crying all the time because of it. And I felt it was my negligence that caused it. And so anyway, I was brought to our family doctor, and she took a pap smear, and it turned out I had a little bit of cancer there. But also, I was 2 to 3 months pregnant. And I had a fetus, 2 to 3 months fetus there, and I didn't know it.
Wow. I need to take just a quick break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves here out of Henry Ford College. And 30 years, we're just getting started. And 89.3 FM on your radio dial, WHFR.FM. On your computer. You're listening to We Are Not Alone I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with experiencer Betty Andreasen Luca and her husband Robert. So let's take a moment to speak to Robert as well. Bob, if I may call you Bob?
Sure enough.
Okay. Tell me, what has been your experience with the UFO phenomenon before you met Betty?
Well, actually, I met Betty in 1977, but unknowns to me, that trip started in 1944. It was during World War II. My dad was overseas, as were five of my uncles, and my mom and I were living with my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
I was obviously a young child. I was on a swing set in the backyard when I noticed a very bright white light in the sky that came closer and closer and finally stopped above and to the left of my swing set.
Mm-hmm.
And this was what today would be described as a typical saucer-shaped object with a dome on top.
Okay.
The thing stopped, and it tipped slightly, and I could see inside two what I called little people. Today they'd be described as grays.
Mm-hmm.
And a very bright light came out of this thing. It was very thin, about the size of like a pencil lead, and it struck me in the forehead. And I was paralyzed. I couldn't move off of my swing set.
Hmm.
And these little guys said that they were preparing something that would be good for mankind in the future, and that people that they had gone to, they said they had gone to many people, many, many people, and that in the future these people would meet. Well, okay.
Hmm.
That was basically the message. But what happened was, during World War II, everybody had a victory garden, as we did.
Mm-hmm.
And the spot where that thing hovered over, nothing would grow there for the longest time.
Right.
So that was a little bit of confirmation. But there was a little more, because when I was undergoing hypnosis years later, Larry Fawcett, a police lieutenant and one of the investigators, brought in a psychic that was very good. She had worked for the government tracking Soviet submarines and things, and she did psychometry. So she took an object that I had always on me, which was my pocket knife, and she described what happened to me exactly. But she went even further. She said, I see these pipes and vines in the backyard there where your swing set is. And I'm thinking, nah, that's wrong. There's no pipes and vines there. But later on, I had talked to my mother, and she said, yeah, your grandfather had built a pipe arbor, and there were grapevines there, and I didn't even remember it.
Well, no, you were little at the time. Huh?
Right. So that was the first experience. Then, moving along, 1967, I'm a young man. I'm on my way to the beach. It's a beautiful, crystal-clear day, not a cloud in the sky. I got to an area known as the New Haven Trap Rock. Excuse me. And there were five men working on the rail spur that went into the trap rock.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them were working. They were all looking up in the air.
Hmm.
So I looked up to see what the attraction was, and there were two huge cigar-shaped objects that were almost like polished chrome reflecting sunlight,
mm-hmm.
and they were floating side by side. There was no wings, no tail section, no windows, no contrail. Obviously, these were not airplanes, and there was also no noise. So I pulled my car over to the side of the road to watch these, and from where I was, they were headed toward New Haven, Connecticut. And as I was watching, two smaller disc-shaped objects dropped out of these large objects, one out of each one. One went toward New Haven, one went in the opposite direction. And it was funny because it looked like they just fell out of the object and then all of a sudden took off.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of strange. Well, I watched till they were out of sight. I started, resumed my trip to the beach. And this is in a very rural area. There were no houses in that area at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm driving along a couple miles down the road, and I saw one of the saucer-shaped crafts was coming back, and it was pulling to the left-hand side of the road. It floated down very gently, almost like a leaf falling on a fall day. Mm-hmm. It stopped a few feet above the ground. Now, this is all conscious memory. I looked at this thing, and all of a sudden, there was a blinding flash of very brilliant red light, almost like a ruby ray laser, very intense red.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I knew, I was inside this thing.
Wow.
And there were, again, what the typical gray being, and they had on a very tight, I guess you'd say skin-tight, red uniform, and on the left side of the chest, there was a lightning bolt emblem.
Mm-hmm.
I was told to remove my clothing, and I was put on a bench that I can only compare it today to plexiglass is the closest way I can describe it. When they put me on this thing, it was like almost like I was super glued to it. There were no restraints at all, but I could not move anything except my eyes, and I had a slight movement in my head, and that was it. They took samples of my skin, my fingernails. They moved my my head, my ankles, and I guess they were testing my joints or whatever. They took a sperm sample, and I was scanned from head to foot with something like an X-ray machine is the only way I could describe it. At the time, I was quite frightened, and they spoke to me but through the mind, and they said, you know, not to be fearful that I wouldn't be hurt. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm not going to be hurt, but I'm stuck here on this table and I can't move. That didn't exactly set too well. What really kind of freaked me out, one of these beings walked around the table to the side of me. As he did, he turned from a solid physical being into a being of just light. Now, I don't know if that's spirit, soul, whatever, but I witnessed it, and that really got to me. That's something I never will forget.
And all this was is conscious memory. It wasn't under hypnosis that you recall this.
Well, this part, the examination was under hypnosis. Everything up to the point of the red light and being brought aboard the craft was without hypnosis.
I see.
Now, they put me back in my car, and I was approximately 30 to 40 minutes from the beach where I was going. However, when I got there, almost 3 hours had passed. And for years, I never knew where that time was. What happened? That's a missing part of my life. And also at that time, I told my parents and I told my best friend, who was a police officer. I did not tell anybody else because in 1967, I didn't want to end up in an asylum or a psychiatrist's office.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And then in 1977, something unusual happened. I had a friend, and he said, you know, he wanted to look for employment in another state. He wanted to take a trip around the country. Well, I was always a hardworking guy. I mean, I was always at work on time, and I put in extra time. I was doing well. I was a service manager for a new car dealership. I had a good salary, a new car every 3 months. So, you know, life was good.
Right.
But when my friend talked about this trip, something clicked in me. And I went to my boss, Eddie, my friend, said, this is going to take us about a month. So I went to my boss, and I told him I want a month off. And he said, no, I can't do that. So I thought about it over the weekend. I came in Monday, and I said, Bob, his name was Bob, too. I said, Bob, I said, there's three things that we can do here. I said, you can fire me, I can quit, or you can let me go, but I'm going on this trip. So, and that's very unusual for me. So we went on a trip. We'd been down through Texas, California, Oregon, and we're on our way home across the northern tier of the country. We stopped at a rest area and just decided on the spur of the moment we're going to Florida. Well, this is several thousand miles out of our way. So we get to Florida, and my friend Eddie had a sister-in-law that lived in Pompano Beach. So we pulled our camp trailer onto her property and stayed there. And the second day we were having an evening meal, she brought up the fact that she worked with a woman that had had this UFO experience. And I said, oh, boy, I said, I'd love to talk to her because, you know, I didn't want to talk to anybody else because of ridicule and whatnot at the time.
Right.
So she told me where Betty worked, and I went down to see her, and she refused to talk to me because Ray Fowler, the book's author, had told her that reporters would be bugging her and whatnot not to talk to anybody. So it took me quite a bit of convincing to so she believed I was not a reporter. We made a date for the next day for lunch. I took her out for lunch that day, and I've been buying her lunch ever since.
I'm lucky.
Yeah.
That's how we got together.
Okay.
And then since then, of course, we've had some abduction experience together where we were both taken at the same time, although we were taken into separate areas.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have both had our fill of the United States government interfering with our lives over many years.
Mm. In what way?
Just briefly, once the first book was ready to come out, we started having these helicopter flights over our house, military helicopters, Huey UH-1s and Sikorsky Blackhawks. Our telephone was tapped. We were followed by cars that had license plates that were unissued. They were checked on by police officer Larry Fawcett.
Hmm.
We were tailed wherever we went, Florida, New Hampshire, Connecticut, where we lived. Our house, two places that were of our residences were broken into.
Hmm.
One, the only thing that was taken, Betty and I were away at doing a lecture, they took three drawings of the interior of the craft that Betty had done, and this is strange because there was jewelry, there was computer stuff, camera equipment, firearms. The only thing that was taken was those three drawings.
That's all they wanted, huh?
Right. Well, where we lived, that was a rural area, so I had to contact the state police.
Right.
And to get a report done for my insurance and whatnot. And we told the trooper what we were involved in and that we suspected it was someone in government.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, look, he said, if I find anything out, I will tell you. Well, a week later, I went down to his office to talk to him, and there was a different trooper there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said the fellow that we had talked to had been transferred, and he didn't know where to. This also happened with an FAA official that had been so interested in the helicopter flights that he drove from Boston down to our house in Connecticut on a weekend to talk to us.
Mm.
We were not home. He did leave a note on our door, and when I called the following Tuesday, he had been transferred, and I couldn't get a hold of him. Then there were also four tax audits in 4 years where they refused to accept canceled checks as proof of payment for water and sewer taxes and things. I had to go to city officials and get signed statements. So they really put a lot of pressure on us because they did not want us to be talking about our experiences.
That's it. Right.
And there were a couple of warnings. One, the first one, we were doing a lecture in Phoenix, Arizona, and I had many slides of these helicopters because they were illegally low over our house, and they had no ID numbers, which is also in violation of federal law.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a pilot at the time. I was just taking my lessons at the time for my pilot's license.
Mm-hmm.
So I was pretty well up on that stuff. This fella came over to me during a break, and he was obviously military, a very short-cut hair, buttons straight down the front, exactly even with the center of his belt, highly polished black shoes. He might as well have had a sign on him.
Yeah.
And he came over to me. He said, look, he said, we're only sending the helicopters so we don't have to hurt you.
Wow.
So I thanked him, and that was that.
Jeez.
Well, later on, we were doing a lecture at MIT in Massachusetts, and Dr. Alan Hynek walked over to Betty during a break, and she was standing alone, and he knew I was pushing the military very hard at that time. And he went over to Betty, no conversation. He just said, stick to philosophy and leave the military out of this.
Hmm.
Then also, when Betty and I decided one cold evening in Connecticut, about 3 o'clock in the morning, we got up and hooked up our little camp trailer and went to Florida without telling anyone. That was on a Saturday evening or Sunday morning, and by Wednesday, two FBI agents showed up at my job and wanted to know where I was. So it became obvious that it was the FBI that was keeping tabs on us, in addition to possibly Air Force intelligence. Mm-hmm. But
well, after going through all that, you still refused to stop telling your story, or did you stop, as I understand it, you stopped telling it for a while?
Well, we did for a little while. We took a break, but right now I'm having a hassle with the FBI because our personal computer was hacked by the U.S. Navy Space Weapons Systems Division, and 48 hours later, it was hacked again by the United States Army.
Gee.
Now, I had worked as a computer technician. I had good software, and I caught them right in the act. My software did. I got the physical street address, the ID numbers of the computers, the operators, the owners, clearly listed as the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Army.
Mm-hmm.
And when I wrote and inquired about it, I got a letter back from the U.S. Army Inspector General stating, yes, it was their computers, and those computers are come under the Department of Defense. So there's an admission. They promised me an investigation would be done. That never happened.
No.
So I went to the United States Attorney General, and they sent me back a letter stating that that is a federal crime and that would come under the jurisdiction of the FBI. So I have contacted the FBI, and they have refused to not only to investigate, but my second certified letter, they refused to even pick it up. They don't want to get involved because it was the Department of Defense.
Mm.
However, they had time to investigate, a sports team's computer hacking.
Certainly.
And I consider the Department of Defense hacking a personal computer much more serious an offense. So no, we're not done with it, and we're not going to be done with it because one way or another, they're going to have to give me some kind of answer.
Well,
I don't know what it's going to take, but whatever it takes, we're going to get to get them to at least look at this because it's a federal law to hack a computer like they did, and it's a violation of my personal privacy rights.
It's
our personal privacy rights.
It's obviously not you and Betty that are a threat to national security or defense. But
well, no, but if that's the problem, anything they don't want to deal with, they just label it under national security.
National security, yeah.
And they can hang you up by the thumbs if they want, and what are you going to do?
Yeah, that's it. So it's what you're unwittingly involved in that they feel is a threat to national security. Is that right?
Well, it is in a way, because if you look at the fact that, Robert Salas has come forward and talked about when they disabled our missiles at Malmstrom Air Force Base, that's happened more than once at more than one base.
Right.
So, and also they fly in and out of our restricted airspace with impunity. I mean, we can't stop them. There's nothing we can do about it. So in that respect, it's a threat to national security, but they're trying to have it both ways, because when you look at what the government says, it says that they're not a threat to national security, and they don't even want to admit that they exist in some cases.
Uh-huh.
So they're trying to have it both ways, and that ain't going to happen.
Mm.
And also, when the first book came out, Betty was even contacted by a representative from the United Nations, and he wanted a write-up of exactly what she witnessed and what she saw, in a signed statement from her.
Mm-hmm.
So there's interest in government,
for sure. There is definitely interest. And it's not you, it's not you and Betty that are the threat. It's the, they want to know what you know about them. And meanwhile, you're churning around and having Fowler write 5 different books on the same subject, telling the world all you know about.
But that was because when I went before the one the first time, and the voice spoke and said, you have seen and you have heard. Do you understand? And I didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a mother of seven children, married, and trying to face life and you know, be faithful and all with the Word of God. But at that time, the voice said, I have chosen you to show the world. Now, what, I don't know exactly what it is that I'm supposed to show. It's gone through me and through me trying to figure out what it is. I thought, well, it probably is because I went through these experiences. So other, and they're out there to the public so people can feel, well, she lived through it. You know, I probably would too. So. You know, it could be something like that, but there is something more because we are writing a book, Lifting the Veil, and there's a lot of information in there. You know, a lot of times also with people that have had UFO encounters, there's also family members that have these things happen.
Right, that's right.
And also paranormal experiences you know, tag along with it for some reason. And it's not only us, but even family members having things like this happen, you know.
There's another aspect, too, that we'd like to get out. You know, because of the government debunkers, and, well, not only government, but there's a lot of debunkers and skeptics out there. Some people are fearful to come forward with their stories, or they think that that there's something wrong with them. They think that maybe they're going crazy, whatever. So we want people to know that, hey, if this happens to you, don't run and hide.
Right.
Because if you get it out and you talk about it, you're going to feel much better once you have this off your chest. And as far as the don't fear the government, because they're the ones that are lying about this.
Right, that's right.
You know, so people should not be fearful about coming forth. I mean, look at some of the people that have admitted their sightings and experiences, like President Reagan, President Carter, astronaut Gordon Cooper. These people were all highly qualified to know what they were seeing, and they fortunately had the intestinal fortitude to come forth and say it publicly. And I think we want people to not fear what will happen. If somebody's going to ridicule you, so what? You know, if somebody says, I don't believe, the way I look at it, there was a time when people didn't believe that the Earth was round. They believed the Earth was flat. Well, that belief made no difference. It didn't affect the globe one bit. That's how it is today. If you know the truth, don't worry about the skeptics.
Right.
People say, you know, I don't believe in that UFO business. And I'll say, that's fine. Doesn't change the facts a bit.
That's
right.
Exactly.
That's exactly how we look at it.
I need to take one more break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Betty and Robert Luca, involved in the Andreessen affair. And I'm going to switch back over to Betty here, and very quickly about the one. You were led to a great light that spoke to you. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. It was strange. From the moment I was taken into the room with the eight chairs, and I was immersed in some liquid and everything, then came out of that, went through another area where these red creatures were, and then from there we were moving along a track, and I could see a city, huge city off to the side, to the left. It had domes and pinnacles there, and then as we moved along a little further, I saw a three-sided pyramid, and it had a head on the top of it, and it looked sort of Egyptian. And as we kept moving along, what happened was I saw these crystals, fantastically beautiful crystals hanging in midair. We went through those, and I was brought before this bright, bright light that was going on. And as we were on the track, the two little beings that were with me got off, and I had to keep on going. It got very, very warm, and I saw a bird standing there, huge, huge bird with its wings down, and I could see the feathers fluffing all around. Mm-hmm. And there was light streams coming out from in back of it as if it was protecting me from the light or something. Mm-hmm. And it was getting so hot there were sparks of fire even coming around. And it got so hot, I think I passed out, because at that time, the next thing I remembered was standing there with there was a heap of gray clay, and out of it came forth a worm. And off to the side there, to the beside the eagle, there was light, extreme, extreme light. And I heard a voice call my name and said, "You have seen and you have heard. Do you understand?" And I didn't understand. I didn't even know why I was there. Mm-hmm. And I told him, and I thought it must be the Lord Jesus, or something with God that is there. And the voice said to me, "I have chosen you to show the world." That is, that has weighed on me quite a bit. And in this book that Bob and I are trying to write, we're not professional writers or anything. Mm. I'm just telling everything that has gone on in our life and the different experiences we've had. And this last experience I had, I've actually got a handprint with the three fingers that was on the mirror. And I had a hard time getting it off, but I got that actual handprint of one of the beings.
Mm.
And so there's more to come that I'm supposed to do.
Now, would you?
I do not know exactly.
Right. Would you equate this this great light with God?
Yes, I would. But it was the One.
Right, the One, the Source, the God, the Creator.
Yes.
Hang any tag you want on it, but it's the One.
Yes.
Okay, so if it was God whose spirit, do you feel that you were in spirit at the time?
No.
Or physical?
No, it felt like I was physical.
No.
Like my whole being was there.
Hmm. Well.
And I don't know how I even stood that heat that and the sparks that were flying around, but I did pass out at that time. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, they say that in, near-death experience, they say they perceive. They perceive hot, they perceive cold. I mean, if they're out in outer space where it's cold doesn't really cover it, they don't freeze because they're not in physical, but they perceive it.
Hmm.
They are aware of it. Same way with heat. The light, they talk about seeing that prodigious light, but it doesn't hurt the eyes to look at it because they perceive the light. So,
right. Well,
but that would not, if you were in spirit, it would not account for these breathing tubes that they placed in your nose.
That's right. That's right. I can understand that too.
So maybe it was a combination of both. Maybe they took you physically and then at some point took you out of body.
It could be. So much has happened to me, David. I don't understand it all. Bob and I are trying to put it in a book. As I said, we're not real writers, but the information will be there, and people can decide for themselves.
That's right.
I believe I have understanding of who the One is and have tried to put it there so people will be able to see it as well.
And
there is one thing I'd like to bring up. In 1978, when we were both taken together, we were taking out of our body, both of us.
Yep.
Okay.
And that was real clear. As a matter of fact, when it very first started, Betty actually saw me sitting on the bed and running toward the door where she was at the same time.
Right.
And the color, when she was taken, the color just faded out of her. And I could see her across the room that we were in, and she had turned completely to a being of just light.
Hmm.
And at that point, I was taken to another area and given some knowledge by the tall
elders,
the ones that they call the elders. They're very tall. They're I'm 6 foot, and I just about came up to their shoulders, and they imparted some knowledge to me, which is, will be coming out. The other thing is a lot of the photographs and the drawings that Betty has done, and even the government documents are all on our website, AndreasAnAffair.com. For anybody that's interested, they can go there and see what a lot of the actual experiences look like that Betty had drawn, and they can see the hassles we've had with the government from the actual documents that are on there as well.
Okay, tell me something. At this 77, you say it was, that this incident happened?
78. That
78. Did you feel during this experience, did you feel like you were in physical body?
There was no pain, not like an aware, you know how you're aware of your body all the time.
Right.
Well, that feeling of awareness was gone.
I see.
I mean, that's the only way I can really explain it to you.
Then let me ask Betty, did you feel during this 67 event, throughout the event, that, you know, you had no pain, but you could feel you were cognizant of the heat, but...
No, I did feel pain at times. Mm-hmm. When the needle first went in, he put his hand on my forehead, and then also when I was measured for procreation, I could feel that when it first went in. I had feelings at different times. I don't understand it. And the heat was really enormous. Mm. And then also we passed through tunnels, and I could tell they were dug out tunnels because the beings put a black hood on their head, the two beings, one in front, one in back. Me and we're on this track, and we're going through these tunnels. And I could see that there were other entrances to these tunnels because they were darker. When we moved close to it, I could, just because of the light of their suit, somehow I could see the darker entrances or something. When we were along this track and we entered into the red atmosphere, it was like a mirror we had passed through as well. So I don't know if I was physical or spiritual or what.
It sounds like
maybe I was kept both of them going on and on.
I was
going
to say, it sounds like a combination of both, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. So you have both had experiences since, must say, 78 then?
Yes.
Yeah. And is this an ongoing thing? I mean, is it happening recently, today, in the past couple of years?
Well, we've had a lot of paranormal things taking place here that is just, you know, we don't understand what they are. Bob has taken a picture. He has put a camera up on the bureau in our bedroom. And, I had gotten up through the night and went into the bathroom. And then I came back from the bathroom. And the pictures that were taken, there were like three balls about the size of oranges. They're zipping off. They're up by my head. And they're zipping off in different types of directions. And he's got actual photographs, the moving pictures of it.
There's a whole plethora of other paranormal events that have happened, and fortunately for us, they've been witnessed by everyone from newspaper reporters to police officers to even the psychiatrist that did the checkup on Betty.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Fortunately, he was there when one of these things happened. And we were out in the front yard, and he looked at me. He said, "Did you see that?" And I said, "Yeah, but I wasn't going to mention it until you saw it first."
Is this going to be on radio as well?
I'm sorry?
Will this be on radio as well? Because we're giving some information from the new book that I wanted to keep some of it for the new book.
No, this will be on radio. So good enough, but... when that book comes out, please drop me an email. Keep my email address.
Yes, did you send a piece of mail through Bob's computer, and he let me read it, and it was different things that you were talking about, the elders and how to try to put the book together.
That was not me.
Same David?
That was not me.
Oh, it wasn't.
No. I'm not going to give you advice.
Okay.
But I would like you to tell us where our listeners can go, because we're almost out of time. But where can our listeners go to find out more about the Andreasen Affair?
Well, the our website, AndreasenAffair.com, and the book can be purchased at Amazon. Also, the other five books, on our website, you'll see a section for Raymond Fowler, and anyone interested can purchase any of the previous books from Raymond Fowler directly.
Okay. Bob and Betty Luca, I want to thank both of you for coming on and sharing this incredible experience.
And, well, thank you. It's our pleasure to be on with you.
And when that book comes out, let me know, and we'll have another interview where you can discuss that one as well, okay?
Well, thank you so much.
It's been great talking to both of you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at WHFR.FM's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, UFOImplications.com. So stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the only station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomena. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
This is
you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Hello, all you guys and dolls out there. You're at the malt shop again with Daddy G here on WHFR Making Waves. And we're going back to the 50s and 60s again. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and join me. Head on down to the malt shop and join me here where the jukebox is playing, the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
She's a solid 17, young enough to dance and sing, old enough to